Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than a half million Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today, I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit NORML.org. First up today, we have two important news stories from Normal. Make sure to catch our separate weekly Normal News podcast. You can link up to the XML online at NORML.org/podcast. First up today from Elk Grove, Illinois. American Academy of Pediatrics slams random student drug testing policies. Tests are ineffective, not backed by physicians, and may push teens towards the use of dangerous drugs and alcohol. Federally funded random student drug testing policies are neither safe nor effective and should not be utilized in public middle schools or high schools, according to recommendations by the American Academy of Pediatrics, Committee on Substance Abuse, and Council on School Health. The committee's recommendations appear in the March 2007 issue of the journal Pediatrics. Quote, currently there is little evidence of the effectiveness of school-based drug testing in the scientific literature, close quote, the committee reported. It noted that student athletes forced to submit to random drug testing, quote, experienced an increase in known risk factors for drug use and poorer attitudes towards school, close quote. The committee also reported that the largest observational study to assess the efficacy of student drug testing, quote, found no association between school-based drug testing and students' report of drug use, close quote. The committee further determined the following. Standard drug tests do not detect many of the substances most frequently abused by adolescents, including alcohol, ecstasy, or inhalants. Mandatory drug testing may motivate adolescents to switch from using drugs with relatively low morbidity and mortality, such as marijuana, to those that pose greater danger, such as inhalants, but are undetectable by screening tests. Widespread implementation of drug testing may also inadvertently encourage more students to abuse alcohol, which is associated with a greater number of adolescent deaths than any other illicit drug. Few physicians report school-based testing of adolescents for drugs. A national survey of physicians found that 83% disagreed with drug testing in public schools. Few schools possess the necessary funds or the expertise to properly implement drug tests or interpret their results correctly. Since 2005, the U.S. Department of Education has appropriated more than $20 million to public school districts to pay for random drug testing programs. For more information on this story, please contact Paul Armentano, Normal Senior Policy Analyst, at area code 202-483-5500. Finally today, from Santa Fe, New Mexico, New Mexico Legislature approves medical marijuana bill. The New Mexico Legislature approved legislation this week that seeks to establish a statewide medicinal cannabis distribution program. On Tuesday, the House of Representatives approved Senate Bill 523, a substitute bill that is virtually identical to the Lynn and Aaron Compassionate Use Act. House members had narrowly rejected a similar proposal last week. On Wednesday, the Senate concurred with a minor House floor amendment, sending the bill to the governor for his approval. As proposed, Senate Bill 523 mandates that the State Department of Health, by October 1, 2007, promulgate rules governing the use and distribution of medical cannabis to state-authorized patients. These rules shall address the creation of state-licensed, quote, cannabis production facilities, close quote, the development of a confidential patient registry, and a state-authorized marijuana distribution system, and, quote, define the amount of cannabis that is necessary to constitute an adequate supply, close quote, for qualified patients. Governor Bill Richardson, who worked closely with the House to persuade members to reconsider the bill, is expected to sign the measure into law. Quote, this bill will provide much-needed relief for New Mexicans suffering from debilitating diseases while including the proper safeguards to prevent abuse. Close quote, he said. He continued, quote, I am pleased that the legislature did the right thing, reconsidered this important bill, and supported a humane option for New Mexicans who endure some of the most painful diseases imaginable. Close quote. If approved, New Mexico will become the 12th state to enact medical marijuana legislation since 1996, though it will be only the fourth to do so legislatively. Joining us today to discuss the New Mexico legislation is Rena Sapansky, the director of the Drug Policy Alliance of New Mexico, who spearheaded this effort. Rena, welcome back to the Audio Stash today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
It's wonderful to speak with you today, Rena. It certainly has been an exciting 2 weeks for medical marijuana there in New Mexico. Rena, tell us a bit about the journey this legislation took.
Well, you know, it's a pretty incredible story. We were kind of on a roller coaster for about 10 days there. You know, the first bill, Senate Bill 238, went to the House floor, and we had confirmed our votes. We fully believed that it would pass. And the final vote, or the first of the final two votes, was 33-33. And one of our supporters rushed into the room at the last second, yelling that his vote wasn't being recorded, and he was punching the button frantically. And so then they moved to reconsider. And at that point, several people changed their votes, and so the bill died at that point, 33-36, and we were all just absolutely devastated, but we mourned for an evening, and then we came in the next morning fresh and ready to work again, and we looked at the other medical marijuana bill, which had been introduced and was strictly for topical purposes, like gels and patches and that kind of thing. And we went to the sponsor and said, you know, do you think you could modify your bill so that we, you know, still include the topical but also allow other ways of using marijuana medicinally? And he said yes. And so the real champion, though, and the real thank you goes to the governor. Governor Richardson really saved this bill. He was very upset that the bill had failed, and he personally met with legislators trying to change their votes.
And this very concentrated and public support for medical marijuana on the part of Governor Bill Richardson. Rena, is that something that's surprising?
Well, you know, he's always been a supporter. Ever since he was running for governor back in 2002, he's issued statements that he supports the bill. Last year, he gave us an executive message that would allow the bill to be heard in the very short budget session. But, you know, he's kind of come a long way in the sense that I don't think he had been meeting with legislators before this year one-on-one and talking to them about this issue. But, you know, I think he's seen enough of the patient advocates here in New Mexico to really understand how critical this legislation is for them.
Now, Governor Richardson is fully expected to sign this into law. What's the next step for this to be implemented?
Well, you know, temporary cards will be issued starting July 1 through the Department of Health for people who meet the criteria set out in the bill. And then the rules must be promulgated by October 1st, and that'll be when you know, the entire program is officially set up. So I think Department of Health is going to start working on this very soon, probably the day after the governor signs it. And, you know, we've got a lot of work to do to get a good program set up, but I think that everyone who's going to be working on it really just wants the best possible system for the patient. So I have full faith we're going to create a really great program here in New Mexico.
And Reno, what was your sense of those New Mexico state elected officials and how they're viewing this issue?
Well, you know, the Senate has approved this bill many times, and each year the margins get better and better. You know, the House, our vote was still very close. It was 31-36, and I think a lot of people have, you know, I think there's still some of that old rhetoric kind of floating around about, you know, sending the wrong message to our children, or, you know, that this is a gateway drug and that kind of stuff. And, you know, we've certainly done our best to educate them. I think some people, you know, there's always a few people you just can't change their minds. And then I think there are a few people who are just kind of nervous about the issue. And I think as they see the program roll out and they see that it's, you know, providing quality care for the patients and you know, I think that that will be what's needed to change their minds.
And this legislation does address the concept of distribution. Rena, how might that work?
We've talked about lots of possibilities, and I think that's probably, you know, we can look to start all of the other states, the other 11 states, for examples as to how to, what the best way to set up the registry is and the ID card system and those kinds of things. The distribution system, though, is something that no other state has in its law. And so we'll be forging into new terrain. And I think that we'll be consulting with lots of national experts. And we certainly want to be very careful about the federal law and the federal situation and it minimize the liability to the state, but also give the patients safe access. You know, I mean, I think that's one of the problems that's been observed in other states is that, you know, if you're really sick, you may not know how to get marijuana illegally. You may not be able to grow it yourself. I mean, it's a lot to expect from someone who's really seriously suffering. So, you know, I think we want a high quality and available supply for patients. And I think that a lot of really smart people are going to be getting together to figure out how that's exactly going to work.
Well, Rena, I want to thank you again for taking time to speak with us here today, and let me give you my sincere and much-deserved congratulations on this bill.
Thanks, Chris. It's been a long road. I'm glad we're at the end of it.
Rena Sapansky is the director of New Mexico's Drug Policy Alliance. We have links to them and more about New Mexico's pending medical marijuana legislation with links at normalaudiostash.com. Make sure to check out our weekly Normal News audio podcast. You can link up online at norml.org/podcast. Also, folks, make sure to check out the links to our eBay auctions. We have some more interesting Normal memorabilia up there. This week, we have a set of signed football cards by Normal Advisory Board member Mark Stepanski. Also, some of those gorgeous marijuana posters signed by Keith Strupp as well. Also, to take note, today is the day of the High Times Doobie Awards at the South by Southwest Music Festival. We'll have some highlights of that next week. And next up today, it's time to take a look at the racial disparity of marijuana arrests in New York City. Dr. Andy Golub is with the National Development and Research Institutes in New York City. And with a grant from the National Institutes on Drug Abuse and the Marijuana Policy Project, Dr. Golub and his colleagues produced the following report, The Race and Ethnicity Disparity in Misdemeanor Marijuana Arrests in New York City. Dr. Golub joined us earlier this week to discuss his research. Dr. Golub, welcome to the program today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks again for joining us. Doctor, tell us what led you and your colleagues to take a look at this data in particular.
Always monitoring various drug trends and arrest trends, and we were trying to make sense of what's going on both with quality of life policing and with arrests for drugs. And in particular, marijuana has become the drug of choice among youths in inner city New York, and we were interested in understanding better how the arrests have changed and the extent to which the mainstay of arrest back in the 1980s and early 1990s was for crack cocaine. And we're wondering what's happened with what might be considered a peace dividend in the war on drugs now that the crack epidemic has entered a decline phase. You would think that we'd be able to save all of that money on the narcotics policing that was occurring.
And where did this quality of life policing effort come from, and how is it practiced?
A lot of ideas floating around and a lot of claims floating around, but specifically what's involved, it's people have different interpretations on quality of life, so I can't speak definitively that there was a moment and somebody said and then there was quality of life policing. It's very, very complex to find out what it was and what it has shifted into. But the whole idea is that the larger theme is that by maintaining civility in general, one creates community and order, and this will reduce larger offending behaviors, such as your burglaries, robberies, assaults, and murders and such will go down. This is the idea of quality of life policing, of reclaiming space for civil engagement.
Now, you and your team looked at over 20 years of arrest data and found essentially that if you are black or Hispanic in New York City, you are more likely to be arrested on the criminal misdemeanor offense of smoking marijuana in public, especially. Is this something that has seen an increasing trend recently?
There's been a massive trend in that. Smoking marijuana has never been a particularly large offense in New York City, never accounting for a very large proportion of all of the arrests in the city. And in the 1990s, it emerged. By the year 2000, 15% of all adult arrests in the city were for smoking marijuana in public view. Now, one of the ideas and one of the possibilities that leads us to think that this is part of quality of life policing is one of the tenets of quality of life policing is to arrest people for minor behaviors, to let them know, to send a message that these behaviors are not tolerated. And in the treatise by Kelling and Coles on fixing broken windows, they talk about arresting people for whatever charge they can who are engaged in uncivil behaviors like sleeping in the subway terminals and such. And smoking marijuana in public view is one of the remaining, the vagrancy laws have been greatly challenged and such, and smoking marijuana in public view is one of the few criminal offenses that you can charge people and have an arrest for. That is a legitimate arrestable offense. Interestingly, the same amount of marijuana use, marijuana is decriminalized in New York City if you have less than 25 grams in your possession in private, or if it is in your pocket, it is a civil violation. It's not legal, but it's a civil violation subject to a fine of, say, up to about $100, and it will not go on your criminal record. It's only when you have a larger quantity or when it's in public view, such as if it is lit, if you have a lit marijuana cigarette, joint, or blunt, and you are smoking it in public, you can be charged with a misdemeanor offense for that. And so we've had a massive increase. There were never more than a couple of thousand of these cases up until the 1990s, and then it increased to over 50,000 cases. And I did a follow-up analysis on these arrests, and in the year 2006, just last year, there were still over 30,000. There were 32,000 arrests for smoking marijuana in public out of a total of 300,000 adult arrests. And one of the interesting things about this arrest is you'd think that, gee, you know, it's not the peak or anything, but what's going on now is that the penalties for smoking marijuana in public view have been increased. And we are seeing the use, the number of people being sentenced to additional jail time has nearly doubled in the last year from 2005 to 2006. And the number of people being charged with a fine has nearly doubled during that period. 25% of adults being charged with this offense of smoking marijuana in public view are being given a fine, whereas in the past, these offenses would have been dismissed, disposed of. So this is an ongoing concern, and it's a part of an ongoing program. And the NYPD is not discussing what it's doing with these offenses or what the purpose of these offenses, but their argument is that this is an offense, and this is within the current legal code to charge the charges that are being the sentences that are being given out.
We're with Dr. Andy Golub on his paper, The Race and Ethnicity Disparity in Misdemeanor Marijuana Arrests in New York City. Doctor, we've been talking about the overall arrest numbers here, but when you look at the ethnic split in the further consequences from those arrests in the justice system, it trends towards harsher treatment for people of color as well. So this is all system-wide. If you're before a judge or a police officer on the street, you're going to receive harsher treatment for a marijuana prohibition law if you are black or Hispanic in New York City.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. The application of the smoking marijuana in public view could be considered a discretionary offense. The police do not have to charge people for this. It's not as if there is a victim who is seeking to press charges and this is a serious offense. They have a choice of dismissing this behavior or not even seeing it at any point in the system. Recently, they have decided that they are going to be seeing smoking marijuana in public view and charging people with this offense. And they are seeing predominantly black and Hispanic people engaging in this offense. 85% of all the people charged with smoking marijuana in public view are either black or Hispanic, greatly in disproportion with their resident population for New York City. This is well out of line with that. And once they get into the system, blacks and Hispanics charged with smoking marijuana in public view are much more likely to be detained for up to, say, 24 hours waiting to be arraigned. And this has been described as, in a sense, doing your sentence up front. You spend a day in jail for being charged with having smoked marijuana in public view, irrespective of whether a judge eventually even finds you guilty of the offense. And then they're finding that blacks, or I'm finding in this analysis, that blacks and Hispanics are more likely to eventually be convicted for the offense, and they're more likely to be sentenced to additional time in jail, further time beyond the detention period, to be spent as a penalty for having smoked marijuana in public view. And I find this disconcerting for race relations in the city.
And, Doctor, is this racism? Many proponents of a change in prohibition laws, especially for marijuana, point to these prohibition practices as a form of institutional racism. is your research hard evidence of that in New York City, at least?
That is the direct question of, is this racism? And it's really, that's a very tough legal standard to prove that an individual or organization is systematically involved in a racist policy. However, what this study shows and suggests, the findings are consistent with a strong possibility that there is a systemic racist policy in place. Moreover, we take the position of, now that you know that this policy is falling disproportionately on blacks and minorities, now that you know that this may be considered problematic and some people in the community will be charging racism, now is the time to address this situation and address the appearances. And I would like to see them, in that regard, cut back on the harshness of this fence and even cut back on the intensity of enforcement. That is, one of the possible claims is that smoking and marijuana in public view is part of their maintaining civility in the very highly public, the very highly prized locations in New York City, where many people are passing through. These are major tourist destinations. These are major recreational destinations. And in these locations, maintaining civility is important. And I think that if they focus their enforcement efforts in those areas, then it would be more justifiable. And it would greatly reduce the number of arrests, because the statistics that we've been following, we've looked at a geographic breakdown, and there have been many fewer arrests in highly public locations, which suggests that if there was a quality of life aspect to enforcement of the law against smoking marijuana in public view over the last 10 to 15 years, then perhaps it has had the desired impact and people are not smoking marijuana in highly public locations such as Central Park or the New York City subway system. That's not where the arrests are taking place at this point.
We've been speaking with Dr. Andy Golub about his report dealing with the racial disparity of marijuana arrests in New York City. We have links to read the full report on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. Tune in to Monday's program, where we'll hear the rest of our conversation with Dr. Golub. Tune in Monday to catch the rest of our conversation with Dr. Andy Golub on this very important subject, dealing with the racial disparity in prohibition enforcement. You're with Normal's Daily Audio Stash today, and Saturday is St. Patrick's Day, a day when everyone is the same color, really my favorite color, the color green. Here's some nice St. Patrick's Day music for you from podshow.com. That was some fine music found at podshow.com. We have links to all the artists at normalaudiostash.com. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.